Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It's easy to get lost in the latest true crime podcast or your favorite binge-worthy show. But what about your own story? That's the most important story of all, and therapy helps you write it. BetterHelp therapy is 100% online and designed to be convenient and flexible enough to squeeze in between the next episode on your list. Get started today at betterhelp.com/pause for 10% off your first month.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
New activation and upfront payment for 3-month plan required. Taxes and fees extra. Additional restrictions apply. See mintmobile.com for full terms.
Jonathan Pearce.
Eric Cantona has jumped in and sees a kung fu kick. A fan.
Terry Alderton.
Do you like shoes, madam?
And friends. JP.
The mad side of genius.
And T.
Good to meet you, love.
The football friendly.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to JP and T, the football friendly, the latest edition. As a special man coming up, who's written a special book, which is very, very funny and very emotional and very sad. And we'll talk about him in a minute. But first of all, Mr. Terry, where have you been?
I've been laying in bed, haven't I? Recuperating, getting myself be back. Not broken and my head not swimmy from me falling out of the. If you didn't join us last week, I fell off a hay bale. I thought I was 16. My son and his friends, they ran up this hay bale. I got up really quick with them, and then I won the prize of coming down the fastest, which gave me a trip in an ambulance, a broken vertebrae, a crushed tongue, and a lot of concussion. But I did get a trip in an ambulance. Brilliant fun. But I'm back, Jonathan.
Do you know what it reminded me of?
Go.
When you sat there all bandaged up and you were in a corset thing and you had a chamois leather under your glasses.
Over my eye, yeah.
It reminded me of what a brilliant visual comic you are. Because I'll tell you what, I finished the podcast and went off and cried myself silly with laughter.
Well, I haven't got the chamois over my eye anymore because I can see straight now. And you can't see people listening, but I'm moving around. I'm physical fit and I'm actually doing some gigs this weekend. So he's back.
Well, I did a game last night, which made me laugh and sort of cry at the same time. I did a playoff second leg for the Champions League, Braga against Panathinaikos, right? Mm-hmm. And you see these players full of their dreams and the fans of getting to the Champions League, and Braga won it 1-0 on the night, 3-1 on aggregate. If they get 2 points in the group stage, I would be very, very pleased. And that's the bittersweet of Champions League. It's all about getting the 21.5 million they'll get now. And you know, it's just a, it's a, it's a false rainbow. Mm-hmm. There's not a crock of gold at the end of, you know, for some of these teams, it's a crock of shit, really, but there you are.
Yeah.
Anyway, I gave it the big one.
Yeah, the other thing, the before we bring on our fantastic guest, answer me this. You texted me the other day that you were doing a game and there was a certain Greek player, and I said you should call him Malacca, which is the Greek word for it. Did you end up, explain to people what happened?
No, but when you say that, just before the preamble, I did Arsenal against Ammonia Nicosia years ago, and they had a fullback called Malakos, and throughout the game, I called him by mistake Malakas, and the Greek and the Greek Cypriot community of North London thought this was hilarious and phoned in their droves saying how funny it was that I'd called this player.
For those who don't know, I suggest
it means wanker. Himself.
It means wanker, by the way, for everyone who doesn't know, in Greek.
It's interesting. Those days, people laughed at it. Nowadays, get him off the air, you know, he's done this. Yeah, well, so look, Panathinaikos had a player whose name is spelled on the back of his shirt, Juankar, Spanish. Okay, and my son speaks Spanish fluently, so I said, how do I pronounce his name? And he said, well, it's pronounced... Wanker. I said, I can't do that in a commentary. I can't say that. His full name is Juan Carlos, but he doesn't, Juan Carlos, you're not Catalan, it'd be Juan, because I thought he might be Catalan and get me out of trouble. No, you've got to say this. I said, no, I'm not doing it. So I called him by his full name that he doesn't use, Juan Carlos, all the way through. But on the back of his shirt, I'm calling him Juan Carlos. He's turned around to the camera, and you can see it in all its glory there.
Juan Carlos Wanker. What a name. I tell you what, as well, you remember when Balak was played? It was brilliant when you'd hear Irish commentators saying that, and there goes Balak. And Langer as well, when Langer was playing golf, because, of course, in Cork, in Ireland, Langer is very much Wanker again, and obviously penis head kind of thing. So look at him. There goes Langer. Brilliant. Anyway, let's get
just before we do another one, when there was
more childishness.
When England won,
he thinks he's come on to a really.
When England, he thinks he's coming on seriously.
Serious podcast.
When England won in Munich, remember that day? And I was working with Tony Girl for Capital Goal, and we sat in the street cafes in Munich the day after. What a glorious morning! They're all walking past, you know, as if the world's coming to, and they can't quite understand what's happened the previous night. We just sat there with a self-satisfied grin on each of our faces, but they had a player called Carsten Janka, and so for the next year we kept saying if anyone you know, horrible miss, we're going, oh, complete Carsten. The commentary, and no one complained at the time. It was of the time. Anyway, look,
come on.
Let's bring in our guest. You might know him as Count Binface, who stood for election for the London mayor.
Yeah.
You might know him for the radio dramas he does, the radio shows he does with Rob Newman. But John Harvey is with us, and we know him for other reasons because he's got a brilliant book out called A Fan for All Seasons, which we'll go into in a moment. How are you doing, John?
Very well, thanks. It's an absolute pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me.
It's mad. I didn't know. I never knew that you were a bin face. And we I'll let you let into listeners. I'll let you into secret. We had a chat just before we started recording. But I didn't know that. I didn't know you were the mighty bin face.
Long story. Here's the short version. Well, I grew up like you with, you know, Screaming Lord Sutch. And do you remember that episode of Blackadder with the standing at the back dressed stupidly looking stupid?
Yeah,
party?
Of course.
All that stuff. So for me, there was always some lunatic who did it. I never expected it to be me. But what happened? Me and my mate, we have a sideline in watching the worst films ever made. The ones that, you know, so bad they're funny. And
yeah, I'm in one of those, by the way, John. Sorry to bring myself into it. Yeah, it's the worst film ever made, mate. It's called Flirting Club. The Flirting Club. It is the worst film ever made. Sorry to interject.
Well, I need to see who else is in it.
Nobody's. It's awful. I play a German in it. It's painfully. It's the worst film made. I think it gets one star wherever it goes. I mean, check it out. But carry on. Sorry, enough about me.
Well, no, I mean, that's exactly the kind of stuff I'm interested in. Like, one I'm trying to track down. Apparently, Shane Ritchie made a gangster film called Shoreditch.
He did.
Yeah, which I think he's made 150 quid.
I know Shane very well. It made the 10 o'clock news for the least ever opening day box office amount of money. Yeah, it made something like £900 or something. Yeah, you're right.
Can Can you get me a copy? Because I mean, honestly, that would. That
I'll
would
tell you what I'll day. Do. I will talk to Shane and I will see what I can do for you.
That honestly would be a dream. So is this anyway? Is this kind of love of the obscure that led me and my friend Tom to we tracked down this film in America? It was called Hyperspace, and in Britain it was called Gremloids, which sounds like a kind of cream, right? but actually, it was a 1984 Star Wars parody, right? And have you seen Spaceballs? But this is like 3 years. But yeah,
John Candy,
brilliant, right? Mel Brooks, amazing film. But this was 3 years before that. So we're like, it's the first time anyone's ever tried to sort of take the mickey out of Star Wars. Let's track it down. So we've got a VHS of it. And it's terrible. It's the special effects are really ropey. It's really dodgy. But the baddie in the film is this Lord Buckethead character. Darth Vader, but with a weird sort of cylinder. Although, weirdly, he's not even called that in the film. He's just called the leader. They only refer to him as Buckethead in the credits. Anyway, that's kind of irrelevant. Whenever I watch a film like this, these days, what you do is you go online afterwards and you read a bit of trivia about the film. And it said, did you know someone dressed up as Lord Buckethead and stood against Margaret Thatcher in the 1987 general election in Finchley? And I was like, no way. You go on YouTube and there he is, just sitting there next to Maggie, some bloke. And then it says, did you know someone also stood as Lord Buckethead against John Major in Huntingdon in 1992? And there he is. And do you know what it was the bloke who got the rights to this sort of crappy film, the rights to sell it as a VHS. He was on the stage next to John Major holding up the VHS trying to flog it. That was it. He didn't speak. He didn't have any policies. All he was trying to do was sell this movie. Anyway, and then it just disappeared. And me and my mate, this was 2016, we thought, wouldn't it be funny to bring him back? You know, 25 years later, another Tory prime minister. Yeah. It was Theresa May. How many was that? Like 19 prime ministers ago now, Theresa May. And we're like, let's have it. But there wasn't supposed to be an election until 2020, until, of course, she goes and calls that snap election. She didn't need to. And we thought, well, why not? And so we had a go for a laugh. I went under the bucket and it went viral around the world. And we didn't tell a soul. It was a complete secret. I was just this rubbish Batman who had this secret that when, you know, I ended up on John Oliver's show and went on Glastonbury and all this stuff. And then the sort of sad bit is this American film producer who made the original film then decided to try and take ownership of everything I'd done and threatened to sue me if I didn't let him have full control of the character. What? So yeah. And this stuff hasn't really come out yet, but I thought, I'll relaunch, and hence Count Binface was born. Basically the most obvious alternative, Lord Count Bucket Bin Head Face, boom, done. And Binface was born. And so
I think we should all go out and put buckets on our head now and see if he can sue all of us. Come on.
I can literally say I'm the first person to kick the bucket and feel better for it.
Ah, there it is.
What the book describes as a kaleidoscopic 12 months from London Olympia to ancient Olympia, from rugby balls to Rubik cubes. You mentioned Maggie Thatcher in there and Dennis, and they come up. We'll talk about the reasons for the Odyssey in a minute, but they come up in a section about, it's quite a sad section actually. It's about the death, you call it the death of a competition or something, the death of the BDO darts competition. But there's one brilliant section in it. We're talking about the owner of Lakeside and Bob Potter, was it? And
that's Bob Potter. I remember Bob. Yeah.
Well, John, you tell the story and how Dennis Thatcher used to pop in there for a drink at Lakeside.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was one of the, you know, hundreds of things that Bob sort of told me within, you know, sort of 45 minutes of monologue. So, me and my friend Will, we'd always been fans of the BDO darts. I'm sure lots of your listeners were, because it was the one on the BBC, you know, and we didn't have Sky back then. So, you know, year after year, it was the original World Championships, and race where Eric Bristow and John Lowe and Phil Taylor, they all made their name. Of course, they all hopped it to the PDC. And so you had this weird world for so many years where there were these two world championships and neither spoke about the other as if they didn't exist. And I talk in the book, the only comparison I can think of is between when there was that WWF wrestling and WCW. And it was just there were these sort of two rival camps, and you just couldn't, you had to support one or the other. And so we went to the BDO, but basically too late. It was, you could tell that this championship was on its knees because the Ali Pally one has gone from strength to strength. And so we were, again, it was partly that spirit of that wonderful British naffness of going to the Lakeside and seeing that, I mean, goodness me, I mean, you played there, Terry, but the people...
Yeah, I've got a photo of me on the wall in there. It's an awful one as well.
I talk about that.
18.
That's in the book. I call it the Wall of Fame, but fame's in inverted commas.
Thanks. I'm on that wall. Yeah.
And every single photo is this terrible shot. You think, my God, what are the ones that they discard?
Yeah. That's exactly the photo of me that's up. I'm about 18 with some cheesy, terrible bow tie and all that. Yeah, it was all that old school, wasn't it? It was like the likes of, well, I tell you, it'll be on there. Like the likes of Bradley will be on there, Walsh. Pasquale will be on there, like from the early days. And in fact, I remember Joe telling me that Potter was saying to him once, he was the reason that he started investing his money, believe it or not, because Joe was like, well, what do I do with my money? I'm earning all this money. And then Potter was one, well, put it into land and property. So anyway, there's a...
Well, this is it. Story. He's this unusual entrepreneur. And so we were sort of immersing ourselves in this sort of wonderful world of 80s nostalgia and celebrity. And then what happens? He gets his tap on the shoulder and it was Bob. And the dance was going on behind us and he just wanted a chat. And he would not stop chatting to me and my friend. We couldn't believe it. It was like being the Wizard of Oz and seeing
how
like
old is he now?
Well, no, he's just passed away. That's the thing.
How old would he have been? I didn't know he died, sadly.
I think he was 88. He's only died. So while I was writing the book, he was still alive. And then he passed just before the book came out. And as JP says, he's sad because I think he was a real bastion of that type of British celebrity. And he wheeled out so many stories. Like he says, Bradley Walsh, he owes me a week here. And then he went off to TV. And then he says, and Dennis Thatcher used to come. I wouldn't let Dennis drive past without coming in. Maggie would be off doing something and Dennis would come in for a drink. And so he this sort of strange chap rubbed shoulders with the great and the good of Britain for a while. We'll never see those times again.
There is a story of Bradley in there, actually, where he... I can't remember. We got to get him on, actually. We need to get Bradley on. But anyway, it's another story. But there is a story where Joe told me and Bradley told me this story where someone was doing Bradley's material before he went on, and then he went on and ended up getting the drums and throwing the drums at this guy and it all going right off. That's where he got the name coined, the Axe Murderer. Joe goes, oh, he calls him the Axe Murderer. Oh, the Axe Murderer's coming. So, yeah, we'll have to get Bradley on to tell the story. But, yes, it is... Is it still open, John, is it? Is it still going? Well,
so the Lakeside's still going. And then... So I was telling the story about the fact that basically a year after I went, they tried to move the tournament to the O2, although not the proper O2, like the little sort of Indigo 2, just Indigo, to the side of it, to try and, you know... I know, resuscitate, a bit like putting the defibrillator on the tournament. It didn't work. So, like, yeah, only 15% of the tickets got sold. And obviously, they'd alienated all the Lakeside fans. And apparently, they're relaunching it as the WDF. And they're trying, it sounds like something you'd use to repair, you know, something in your shed. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's coming back. And they're going to do a new World Championships either end of this year or beginning of next year. But to be honest, it does feel like the boat has sailed a bit, and you know, it's basically going to be I think it's like the FA Trophy of darts now, isn't it? You know, like FA Vars, where the non-leaguers are gonna the amateurs get their chance. That's basically what it is, because the pros have all they've all jumped to Sky.
The journey you went on is full of those little one-liners like you've just done there, but it's tinged with sadness, John, isn't it? Because you tell the story. Where did it all start? Because you're a Tottenham fan. Your brother Daniel was a Crystal Palace fan, and it starts with terrible sadness, really.
Yeah. So the reason I wrote the book is my brother Dan, who was the biggest Palace fan you could ever hope to meet, and biggest sports fan you could ever meet. he very sadly passed away in 2015, completely unexpectedly. He wasn't exactly well. He was overweight and didn't look after himself. You know, like thousands of football fans, we all know. You know, but was living his
We're both pointing. Jonathan and I at this point. Oh, hold on! I've come unplugged. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, Jonathan and I at that point are both pointing at each other.
Well, yeah, and me too. You know, but most of us are caring a bit, but Dan, he had so much undiagnosed, you know, like he had diabetes and probably like some neurodiversity anyway. And he passed away sort of shockingly. And I sort of found him one day the summer 2015. And a part of it, because sport was the biggest thing of him, when we held his wake at Palace and it was like, what do you do next? And I inherited his Crystal Palace season ticket, even though I'm a Spurs fan. So, you know, for a lot of people, you'd be like, that's a fate worse than death, right? But that's what I did. I went to watch his team for a whole season. I was his eyes and ears at Selhurst. And he'd taken me there for year after year when I was a kid. It was our local ground. And I sort of talk in the book, I was thinking about it just this morning before coming on the pod and thinking just how those little grounds have really grown you over the years. Like when I was a kid, Selhurst Park was sort of a bit of a joke because it didn't look like all the big grounds that you see on the telly, you know, your Anfields and your Old Traffords and obviously Wembley. But so many grounds now have been knocked down and replaced by, you know, the sort of identikit bowls on the ring road outside town that, I drove past the Amex the other day. It's beautiful in its own way, but, you know, it's almost like they've just been planted there, you know, and they all look the same. Whereas Selhurst Park is this survivor. And it's there, right in the middle of the streets. And you guys will know plenty more grounds around the country like that. You know, Southend must be like that, I'm
correct.
Assuming.
And right, Brentford used to be like that. Sadly, not anymore. You know, like you say, just bang in the middle of a load of houses. Yeah.
That's right.
And at the end of the season, I can tell you, if I get the last Everton game at Goodison Park, I should cry when I'm there, very probably on air, because it's, you know, resonance goes back to 1966 in the World Cup, and it will be the last of the great old-fashioned grounds to go. So, but why did you... I know then that the journey sort of started after he died, and you went to the Palace, and then you went with his co-workers to racing, didn't you? Is that where it's the sort of idea came to do this odyssey? Why did you do it?
So, yeah, what happened was, because he was into everything, the very first thing that happened was that it just so happened that his work colleagues used to go on an annual trip to the races. He was a huge racing fan, you know, especially the Grand National, but, you know, anything, he absolutely would love it. He'd be pouring over the racing post weeks in advance. And so that was the first thing I went to after he died. And that sort of, I guess, planted the seed that, you know, sport actually was that thing that we still had in common. And it happened gradually, because then, the Palace season happened. And that was way more emotional than I thought it was going to be, because it ended up, this was the 15-16 season, which you guys will remember, that ended up with Palace in the cup final. Mm-hmm. And they played Man United. And for us, it was this weird ring composition, because that was exactly the same game that had happened in 1990, which was Dan's first year as a season ticket holder. You know, that amazing final, the 3-3 game, which was basically for us, like off that cup run with them beating Liverpool in the semis and then that big final against United, that kind of sort of put rocket boosters on our love of football. It was just before Italia 90 and a couple of years before the Premier League. It felt like I really experienced the magic of football through that. And so it was so weird for the first year that Dan to not be around, for them to be back at Wembley and facing United. And if you remember, what happened was they very nearly won it again. And somehow contrived a way to lose against 10 men. And the most famous thing about the game is Alan Pardew's dancing. I mean, that is just so
powerful. Yeah.
You know, that's all people remember.
Yeah.
So it was after that, I was sort of stuck thinking, what do? Do I keep this ticket up? Because he'd had that seat at Selhurst for, you know, over a quarter of a century. And Dan was such a sort of completist that the idea of giving that up just felt so wrong. And yet, I'm a Spurs fan because we always had to have like our rival teams. It was, I know lots of brothers and lots of dads and sons, they have to support the same team, but that was never a question for us. We always just loved to have that game element to sport. So we always, so it meant that we could go and watch Spurs and Palace every year and have a laugh. You know, that was part of it. And so I thought, well, how can I look after his memory in another way? And I went on a holiday to ancient Greece. Well, didn't go back in time, but back to sort of Olympia. You know, where the original Olympics were held, because I'd never been to those sorts of places, and I couldn't afford to go to Rio, where the proper Olympics was. So I thought I'll get myself a little fix by having a history trip, and then it's just sort of struck me, this idea that maybe I could go and see lots of the different things that he loved and try and cram in as many as I could in a season, and that might be a way to build like a different kind of season ticket. And so it just built sort of organically from there, and I had no idea at that point what was even in the calendar for that year. I just thought I'll just say yes to everything. So before I knew it, I was at the Stoop watching Harlequins. I went to Wembley to watch the NFL. I mean, that's weird when you're watching a home game for the Cincinnati Bengals at Wembley, but there you are. And then you had the darts, like JP has said. I even went to the World Rubik's Cube Championships in Paris, which is a thing. I just said yes to everything. And it was an incredible journey. And obviously, it's very sad as well, but I just felt if I could just keep his fire burning, that would be a way to sort of cope with grief. That's what I'm still doing now. So, you know, it has helped. You can't solve grief. No one can. But, you know, by the fact that I'm talking to you guys now is part of the sort of celebration of his memory. Because I can say without any exaggeration, he was a huge fan of Mr. Pierce. A massive fan. We were early adopters, JP, Capital Gold Sport back in the day. You were the soundtrack of our childhood. I'm not kidding.
All of us, not just you, John. Not so much childhood, though. Not for me. I'm a bit older.
That's very kind. You come up with it's a lovely book, honestly. We don't really do books on the podcast, John, but we thought we would because it's so lovely in the writing. I really liked it, and there's a lovely line in it where you say grief is like quicksand in the head; it just keeps sucking you back in, and you do get that feeling throughout the book. He's with you, he's with you. Dan's with you on the journey. So was it cathartic? Did it ease the grief, when you go to the game still, because you're back going to Tottenham?
Let me add on that question as well, if I can, John. I'll just piggyback on that. A lot of people when they lose people, they start seeing dragonflies and robins and such like. Do you, on Jonathan's question, have you been to a game and gone, that's weird. He's got to be here somewhere. That's a bit strange.
Yeah, or yes to all of that. I mean, as far as how do I cope? It has been cathartic, JP. That's definitely true. That because sport is like nothing else, and I think in the last few years I've realised that more than ever. I've always loved sport, but I've actually come to think of it as one of the most incredible inventions we've come up with as a species. Mm. Because if you think about it, it's drama but without a script. It's war but without death. It's something which billions of people on the planet pour their souls into like nothing else. You know what it's like when the World Cup's on or the Olympics on. It's like the world stops. And I know there are obviously loads of people out there who don't give a toss about sport. And that is a completely valid opinion as well. Don't get me wrong. Yeah, but I love what Stephen Fry says. He says, yeah, sport is unimportant, but it's the most important, unimportant thing in the world.
Very good.
And you know those feelings, it's when you're at Lord's and you watch an important wicket fall, or, you see a goal go in, or an important penalty, or a miss, last night, Sanchez missing one for Spurs. Just in that moment, it is like grief or like your ultimate celebration, because we throw ourselves into it so much. And so I think if Dan's passion had been something else, like, I don't know, the theatre or something else, I don't think I could have done what I'd done with the same level of, of retaining his joy. I do think there's something unique about sport, and that has helped, because it is. I'm so glad you picked up on that quote, JP, about grief being quicksand in the head, because I think that is what sums it up for me. That this, it could happen today. There could just be a moment where the sadness just becomes almost overwhelming. And last night was a big one. Who were the big two games in the Carabao Cup? You got Palace playing Plymouth on Five Live. You got Spurs playing Fulham on Sports Extra. Our teams, and they're both losing, and they're both making a complete pig's ear of it. It feels like it's being written for us. And of course, what happens last night? Palace climb their way out of it. Spurs on your bike as usual. So I could almost hear him laughing. And then, I mean, as you say, Terry, little moments pop up where you go, that can't be anything other than him. One happened when, I took his seat at Selhurst, and weirdly, he'd actually moved his seat for the next season because he'd had a disagreement with another fan who he'd been getting into the ground. And so Dan decided to sit in a different bit of the ground. He was right in the corner of the Holmesdale where the tunnel is, about sort of 10 rows up. And one time, I mean, it's like a couple of games in, they have this eagle at Palace, a real one. They've got Pete the Eagle, who waddles around in the furry suit, but they've got a real one. I don't know if it's still, but then it was called Kayla.
Gone now.
Oh, is Kayla gone? Well, I'm not surprised. Kayla got punched by a Charlton fan, so she was a survivor. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
In 2010. They actually did an eagle. They do that. What?
Yeah. Exactly. That's football fans for you. But yeah, so she'd been through a bit. And then one day, she just came and flew past the goalpost and came and sat next to me. And birds have these fascinating eyes. They're so alien to us as humans. Yeah. And she was just looking at me. And obviously, I was just for a second, I was like, come on, what's going on here? And then as soon as you think it's gone away, and then she was off as well. But there was another one at Twickenham when I'd just been to watch England, France, and England just scraping a victory in the Six Nations. And I was walking home because trying to get home on the train is a nightmare from Twickenham, like so many grounds. And I was walking over a sort of Richmond Bridge. And around there's this sort of almost like marshland, and out of the gloom, out of the dark, this sort of heron started walking towards me, and I was like, and herons are like, they don't want to be near humans, they're not tame. But he just started walking, and he just started stopped there, just started clocking me, and I was clocking him, and then out of nowhere, three more turned up. It was this family of herons just looking at me. I thought, this is so weird. And again, for a minute, you're like, oh, come on. This is something, this doesn't feel real. But then, you know, next minute, they're off. Yeah, they're off hunting fish again. But
this, let's do a really bad pun there, should we? You're being stalked. Yeah, we're going to say that.
There we go.
You've got to say the gang. I'm only bringing that in because we've got to take a break, unfortunately. But you and your avian stories will continue, I'm sure. We'll take a break.
JP&T, the football friendly.
Welcome back to JP and T. We're talking to John Harvey about his book, A Fan for All Seasons, an odyssey in honour, in memory, in love of his brother Daniel, who died. And just before the break, we were talking about, you know, sort of magic of sport and the quirkiness of sport, and a lot of things come through in the book, funny things that happen in sport. I mean, there's a great picture of when you were at the golf, and you've got a picture of Rory McIlroy walking through waist-high grass. These bizarre things that happen in sport, bizarre things you see, John, that you must have counted in your odyssey. It's just typical, I think, of sport, that you can just remember just weird moments of any sport you've been to.
And that's it, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, the McIlroy one was weird. It was like being on a safari. If you've ever been to golf, I'd never been to golf before. And just wherever you look, there are these massive global superstars, but just, yeah, like say, stuck in a hedge trying to find a ball. It's weird. But I think maybe going to, I don't know if you guys find this, that you've been to probably a lot more top level sport than I have. And it humanizes it, really, because you realize these people are just people. And I think for me as a sports fan, I talk in the book, for me and Dan, we didn't have much money growing up. So sport for us existed on the TV. You know, the snooker, it was just inside the TV. The idea of actually getting to the Crucible and being one of those 900 odd people just seemed unfathomable. And so to actually get to that and see Dennis Taylor was real, not just a sort of computer sprite or something.
It
was,
and his glasses, absolutely.
Yeah, and his glasses. And he even played a game. What happened? I went there and a match finished early. And they thought, oh, we can't leave the fans shortchanged. So Dennis came out and played an exhibition match against Peter Ebdon. It was, and then he started doing trick shots and stuff. And honestly, Dan would have been just doing cartwheels at the idea of seeing Dennis, you know, sort of reliving his Black Ball final glory and everything. So I think whatever your sport, I mean, going back to the tunnel at Palace at Selhurst Park, you know, every week I was seeing people like, you know, Wenger or Harry Kane or Aguero walking past, and we're used to seeing them as giant figures on screens or on buses and everything. And you realise through the magic of a season ticket that no, these are just normal people, and this is their job. It's an incredibly well paid job and incredibly glamorous one, but ultimately these are real people and they're fallible. And that's why there's this weird paradox, because I'm sure I'm like you when you're watching your teams and a player does something wrong, you know, you go like, oh no, or you know you shouldn't have done it, pass it to him, or you realize that these are exceptional professional athletes, and the last thing they need is idiots like us telling them, as if we've got, now we're all going on about inverted,
spitting out your pie,
yeah spitting out your pie and shouting about inverted fullbacks, you know, invert, as if we know what's
box
going
it,
on,
box it, box it,
yeah. And you realise that these there is something slightly weird about us thinking that we're experts in a game which is so intricate.
You know? Let's ask the commentator, when the commentators say, you don't do it that often, Jonathan, to be fair, but you go, well, maybe you should have squared it there, or maybe you should have, you know, what is the kind of the etiquette on that, Jonathan?
Well, young commentators coming in, and there's a couple who work now on the BBC. They asked me for any advice a few years ago, and I told them, get coaching badges. You know, do your coaching badges, do your work, go to clubs, meet people at clubs. You know, all off the record, talk to them, get advice. You know, ask them what they're trying to do. Go to training grounds. I'm not too sure whether they've done that. Certainly, one of them, from listening to the commentary, possibly hasn't. But anyway, that would be my, you know, I started my badges when I was 18, and then went back to them later on in life, and coached for a decade, and you know, I played for a club in the Midlands, and we were very, very successful, and we won things and got promoted a couple of times. And then at 21, I think I was, I took over as player manager on the basis of these badges, and we were relegated twice. And it was a bit of a disaster. And I had to do the washing. I had to wash the kit. And so consequently, every weekend we turned out in mouldy, dirty, wet kit because I never washed it. But there you are. So don't take what I say. Take it with a pinch of salt. One of the things that, the other thing that I would say from my past, and we've all done this, blagged our way into different areas of sporting occasions, and you did at the Grand National, didn't you? And with your mum, you blagged into the wrong area.
Yeah, but not deliberately. I've done a bit of deliberate blagging in my time. When the best one for that was because I got this bug of trying to see sport. I carried on after the time in the books. There's something I don't talk about was the next year there was the World Chess Championship in London, right? And you'd think that'd be the most dull thing you could possibly go and see, but I'd caught the bug so badly by that point that I thought I've got to go. And but it was £500 to watch chess. I thought, wow. I'm not doing that. So I just wrote to, yeah, insane, right? And it just goes on for day after day, nothing happens. But I thought, I'm not doing that. So I just wrote to them and said I was a journalist. And they went, of course, come in. And so I got this executive seat just by, I got treated like royalty. It's brilliant. And I've never written a thing about chess in my entire life. I just liked
it. You're now on the world's most favourite podcast talking about it.
Exactly. Coming clean. Yeah. So come and get me, guys.
He's blagged on this now.
Exactly. Tens of millions watch us and listen to us. Well, tens.
Yeah. Ew, tens or millions, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so you got the wrong side of the fence at Aintree.
That was fluky. What happened was I went to the Grand National with Dan in 2011 because he was obsessed with Aintree and the whole race. He fills my head is still full of weird Grand National trivia thanks to him. Basically, I could probably tell you any winner, certainly for my lifetime. It's just all lodged in my brain. And so we had to go, and we had a lovely time. But that time he managed to get us a spot underneath the winning post. And we thought, oh, great. It's quite cheap to stand here. Great. And just had a great time. That was it. And so when he died, I took my mum to do the same thing in 2017. And so we went to the same bit of the same track and thought, this is no problem. The only difference was I needed the loo before the race. And so I thought, oh, mum, I'll be back in a minute. Nipped out. And by the time I tried to get back, all these barriers had been erected. And the steward said, can I see your ticket, please? I said, yeah, sure. I said, you can't go in there. I said, well, what do you mean? I've just been in there. My mum's there. They said, no. You've got the cheap seats. You're over there, mate. And pointed miles away, like down the track. And I was like, but we've been watching the racing all day. And he said, no, not for the Grand National. You're not. No, this, you have to pay top dollar for that. I said, but my mum's there's no. And you know what weird thing, like your phone reception goes when you're in huge crowds, especially at sports events. So I couldn't get hold of her. I was like, she's speaking to me, she's going to be worried about me. And they just thought I was completely on the blag. I said, pull us another one. Because I imagine there's probably, not just in that part of the world, but let's just say there's some worldly wise race goers who have probably been pulling that stunt all afternoon, right? And so she was like, no, you're not coming in there. So I had to tell her the truth. I said, you know, I'm here because of my brother. Me and my mum are trying to remember his memory. And they went, well, all right. And they frog marched me back to the winning post to find my mum, to make sure I wasn't pulling her leg. But luckily mum was there and was like, and she just saw me being basically accompanied by two security guards going, what on earth have you done? It's like, oh, I've just been to the loo, honestly, nothing's wrong. But they decided they wanted to make an example of me. But luckily got back there, watched the race and picked the winner. Can't beat it.
Oh. One for Arthur. He went off at 14-1. I think I got it at 20. So
yeah. Oh, right.
One up let me just go back towards the start of the book. The book is called A Fan for All Seasons. I don't know whether that's a play on A Man for All Seasons, which was a play written by Robert Bolt. Mm. And the book features no relation to Robert, but the namesake Usain Bolt. And it sort of bookends the book. You start with your brother Daniel commentating down a phone to you in a restaurant in a different part of the world on Usain running Beijing. That's a good story. He was running Beijing, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right. So again, we're huge fans of the Olympics, and the idea of not watching the 100 meters final was just alien to us. But that Beijing Games, this is 2008, wasn't it? I'd made a complete cock up and agreed to go on holiday with my then girlfriend to Germany, into Berlin during that Olympics. And worst of all, we'd agreed to go for lunch with a friend during the 100 meters race because I got the time zones wrong. So I was like, I've got it's all wrong. But just before the race, and this is pre-smartphone, so you couldn't just, you know, sneak a little look, you know, on your lap during the meal and just watch it that way. No, it's sort of 2 years before the iPhone or something like that. So what do I do? And I was like, oh, I'm resigned to just not knowing. And then Dan called out of the blue and just said, are you watching, bruv? And I said, well, no, I'm in Berlin. He said, don't worry, I've got you. So I said to them, I'll just back in a minute. Just stepped outside the restaurant. And yeah, Dan gave me this, let's just say, not exactly a Pierce-esque commentary. In the words were few and far between because he started doing it, and as the race went, he just stopped because his tongue got tied because he couldn't believe what Bolt had done. You know, he said, Bolt's had a slow start, bruv. He's catching up, and suddenly he just went, oh my god, no. Oh my god, okay. What's happened? Like, has a streaker gone on to the track? Has there been a bomb threat? What's happened here? And the reason he'd gone quiet is because that was the race, if you remember, where Bolt slowed down.
Yes.
He was so far ahead.
Yes.
That he coasted and still got a world record.
Yeah.
And no one had ever seen anything like it. And I mean, it's like Muhammad Ali at his greatest, that sense of showboating on the greatest stage. Who does that? And yeah, Dan was the one who, he made it more real for me than maybe watching Steve Cram or David Coleman could have been, because he, in his own weird way, he summed up how speechless it left you.
It's one of those Ali, oh my God, he's won the world title back moments, Harry Carpenter commentating, and or when Seve won and did the little jig on the green. You remember these things, don't you? It's like, sport remains eternal for you. And also that right at the end of the book, you were there when the burst from Usain didn't happen at the World Championships, the sad World Championships. Was, again, the book is permeated with sadness. And that moment really touched me, where he leaves the stadium, his last ever run. He leaves it in a wheelchair.
Yeah, I mean, there was so many weird mirrors for me, because the 2012 Olympics was such a happy time for me and Dan. Yeah, we managed to get lots of cheap tickets to that, so we were there basically every day, and that stadium meant so much to us that we actually illicitly scattered his ashes outside the stadium. There's this little garden outside, although you're not supposed to do that, so I'll just for the record say we definitely didn't do that. But you know, to be back at the stadium was really special, and for Bolt to be, you know, returning 5 years later for his final race just seemed so poetic. And you know, I, like everyone, I thought we were going to see his final gold. And as JP just mentioned, well, it didn't go that, did it? You know, he ended his last race basically being carted out in a wheelchair because his hamstring went, you know, in the relay. And that's not, but luckily no one remembers that. And he's immortalized for what he did, not for how he ended. But for me, for the story, there was something really poignant about that ending, because that in a weird way was the sort of lesson of what's happened with my brother, is that things don't go the way you expect, and they can go wrong. It can go as wrong as they can go. And so it's strangely more fitting, a bit like Palace not winning the FA Cup final after Dan had gone. You know, it was more fitting that I was having to come to terms with how different life could be through watching Bolt not win than if he just, you know, sauntered through to a third gold. So it's strange how it sort of went that way. But
it's like Zidane as well, isn't it, with the headbutt?
Yeah. I mean,
that's the way you're going to finish your career.
Things don't go well. And Terry and I have noticed this in the book, John. You know, you talk about greyhound racing at Wimbledon and going to Wembley, Prawn Cocktail Brigade, the Lithuania Gareth's first game in charge at home, that was. And that was a sad night as well. Graham Taylor was remembered that night. It was a weird old night, that. And the boat race, you talk about that. But then, hang on a minute. At the back of the book, you sort of, you make a, you know, you, I don't know what you call it, a list of all these things you went to. And there's a lot of Spurs games you went to during this year that you actually don't talk about in the book. Is that because, as a Spurs fan, you can't bear to talk about them? Is it because you're a Spurs fan? Because a lot of them were actually Spurs victories, apart from the FA Cup semi-final when they got gubbed by Chelsea. But is it because, oh my God, I'm a Spurs fan, I can't court fate by talking about them?
I've gone past that now, JP. I've now realised I'm convinced, and I'd like you as an expert to look into this for me. I think Spurs are cursed. in the same way that, was it the Chicago Cubs or the Red Sox? One of the big baseball teams had this 100-year curse, but they couldn't win the World Series. There's something going on that the last, I mean, if you, I don't, do you even count the League Cup in 08? I don't know if we do, but if, even if we do, right, we count the League Cup. So it's now, fit, and we're out this season's one, so that's going to be another 16 years. I mean, I can't see us winning the FA Cup. So what's going on? I cannot think of a team or a squad in top level football, certainly, men's or women's, maybe even sport, who has had such a roll call of talent and failed to win anything. And to give you an example, 2018 World Cup, I think it was the 2018 World Cup, in the semi-finals, there was only one team in Europe, certainly in Europe, probably in the world, you could build an 11 of past and current players in the teams that are in the World Cup semi-finals, and it was Spurs. It's obviously a bunch of Croatians, bunch of French, bunch of English, probably a couple of Brazilians. You know, it was, that's how good the level of talent, and that's despite them not spending the same amount as some of the other teams. And so for Spurs to fail, is, I think it's more impressive that Spurs haven't won something than they have. So that's, does that deserve a trophy? I think it probably does, right?
They're not in Europe. They're only in two cup competitions. They can only win two cup competitions because they're out of Europe. He plays a weakened team, they go out of one of them. They've only got the FA Cup. They're not going to win the league. No. They've only got the FA Cup to win. That's crazy that he I'm a big fan. I've met him a couple of times now, and he's very, very nice man, very approachable, very charismatic as well.
Why don't look you in the eyes, though?
No, well, he looks down, doesn't he, at the moment?
Yeah, he looks down at the floor.
I think, that might change, but that just drives me mental. Did it drive you mental to see that team last night at Fulham?
I was really surprised that, I think we've just got so immune to the idea of, I think Wenger was one of the ones who pioneered it, that the League Cup is just your chance to rotate the squad. And so I wasn't as surprised as maybe I should have been. I was surprised it's half time that I was just like, because he wasn't on TV, so I was listening to it and sort of looking at it online. And apparently Lo Celso, who can't get a game in the first team, you know, had apparently a decent first half and he got hooked. And I was like, well, I sort of feel sorry for him if he can't get a full game in this. And I don't know, maybe he said this morning that he said, well, you know, we haven't got any European games, so how on earth do I get a chance to look at the squad? We've got this bloated squad. It's probably putting people in the shop window, to be honest, because if Højbjerg's off to United, it might have put a few million on him if he'd scored a goal or something. I don't know. I've got no idea. But I'm a big Ange fan, and I love this version of Angels that's come. Have you seen this?
Robbie Williams.
Yeah, Robbie Williams has done it, this version of a Spurs thing. I think the feel-good factor's back. I mean, for the reason I didn't put them in the book, I did one Spurs game, which was that last game at White Hart Lane against United. Because the editors were like, you know, it's a book about all sports. You can't go too big on. If someone wants me to write a full book on Spurs, I'll do it. But I thought I'll just pile it all into that last game, which was incredibly emotional. Were you there for that one, Jonathan?
I can't remember. I was at West Ham's last game at the Bowling, but I can't remember whether I was at the. I don't think I was. No, I wasn't.
The West Ham one's probably similar. My God, what an atmosphere! Because the fans. The game was almost incidental. It was like this sort of greatest hits medley of all the chants for 50 years, you know. So it was wonderful, you know. I've been going. The dad took me to my first game there in '94, and so I was looking up at that stand that was about to get knocked down, and you know, it was very emotional. Of course, Spurs, unusually, the new ground is in the same site as the old one, which is weird. So it sort of is and isn't the same place, whereas, of course, West Ham have moved. But, yeah, I was getting to hear chants for people like Steve Archibald and people like that. It was brilliant. You really feel like you're part of a moving history. And, again, that's another thing where being a fan makes you plug into something. When I hear the Palace chants, you know, the chants that Dan would have been singing, it feels like something. There's a collective organism about being a football fan. You know, there's something wonderful about being at the ground. So, yeah, I mean, the main reason for not putting more Spurs in was probably just to avoid boring fans. I mean, there's a couple of other things that don't make it in. I went to watch motor racing, but I couldn't get into the British Grand Prix because it sells out, you know, years in advance, whatever. And it's incredibly expensive. Whereas a mate of mine, who's a big petrol head, said, oh, you don't do that. Just go to France. He said they do motor racing in this place called Pau, which is just like Monaco, but it's inland, but a very similar street circuit, windy street circuit. He said, yeah, they do like historic motor racing there. He said, you'd watch it for like €9. So we went down there for a weekend and had a brilliant time. Brilliant. And I really recommend that. But just for space, that one didn't make it into the book. But Dan was such a completist that I had to put at the end every single fixture that I went to in his memory. So that's why they're all there.
So where can we get the book? Can you get it on Kindle and all the usuals?
Yeah, all the usuals. So if the obvious place is Amazon, and I did an audiobook as well, which was great to do. But you know,
did you record it? You've done
I did it too. It was just during that typical my luck. It was just during that hot spell. You know, you wouldn't remember it now. This summer's been a bit of a washout, but. Do you remember in like June when the Ashes
first
started?
The hottest June.
It was melting, wasn't it? And I was in this voiceover studio doing the audiobook, which was weird because I'd written the book to be read originally and it's one thing putting emotional thoughts on paper, but having to read them out was a whole new challenge.
Have moments where you had to stop? Did you have to go, hold on a second? Hold on.
There are a couple. Yeah.
There's
a lovely bit in the book, very, very early on in the book, when you're talking about the cricket and the Ashes and everything, and you're big fans of TMS, Test Match Special, if people don't know, which is like, if you don't know, then you should listen to
it. The T-shirt, you can't see it.
You know, it's unbelievable, Test Match Special, it's never aged, it's brilliant. This is what John writes. While television is unbeatable for presenting the physical reality of cricket, TMS is the more accurate transmitter of its emotional reality. You can write that about any sport. And for me, that's one of the most resonant lines in the book, that is, because working in both media, I love radio because you are talking to one person. When you're broadcast on the radio, you have a relationship with one listener. That's how I've always broadcast.
Yeah, that's how I was always taught. Yeah,
yeah. So, and you can get the emotion of the thing. You paint the picture, and you get the emotion of the thing through television. Is a behemoth. It's huge. You're talking to millions, and it's not the same way. But and of course, the pictures tell the story more than the words. But I don't know. I don't know, John, if that's a thing that's carried you through with your relationship with Dan. That beauty of sport through both media, I guess, but for me, radio is always special.
Yeah, it totally is. And I would just want to bring you back to Capital Gold Sport, because I don't know how many listeners were Londoners back then, and because Jonathan, you were the voice of London, really. And and you say as a broadcaster, you have a one-on-one relationship with Lister, and I can tell you it's totally reciprocated, because for me and Dan, like, we felt like you were ours. Like, I'm gonna get emotional about this, because honestly, like, it was our treat. Capital Gold, that's, I still play, when I need a pick-me-up, I still play the Capital Gold theme tune. The it's called Lap of Honor. I didn't know that at the time.
Yeah.
That sports theme tune, it always gets me. And for us, when you went to, when you went to the Five Live and then hearing you on the TV, we felt a bit like, oh, he's ours. Like, no, don't leave us. Yeah. You know, like, it's like, oh, he's off in the big leagues now. And because there's something so intimate about radio and hearing your voice, honestly, JP, you basically took us through so many ups and downs of sport, and you fans really do form a relationship with broadcasters. It's so important. And I'll tell you another thing I've got to compliment you on is, it's only in recent years, I don't know whether you mention it more now or whatever, but knowing you're a Bristol City fan, right? But as a Londoner listening to you, you couldn't pick what team you supported, because you were so enthusiastic about, from Orient to Spurs to, you know, obviously Palace. Like, I thought, oh, he's got to be a Palace fan. He's so up on the Eagles. He loves it. There was one, I'll never forget one match where Palace had scored. I almost said we. Oh, God, no. No. See what he's done to me. Palace scored, and you said something about they're going to be cheering in the Crowham Arms down in the Harrow, and I was like, "How does he know these pubs? I look well. He must."
I used to drink in them because I lived in Croydon, and I was a season ticket. My father-in-law, he's been Palace since the 1950s. One of my kids is Palace, the other one's Brighton, but which is interesting, and so I used to drink in the Stag in South Croydon, and now sadly gone. And we used to go to the Crowham, and John, really, The main reasons I mentioned these pubs was so that I got a free drink
free
in those
beers.
Pubs.
Yeah, of course it
so was. There's no, you know, there was no beautiful reason behind this whatsoever. It was purely financial. Yeah, it was just to get, you know, other pubs are available, but I got most free pints in those pubs. So there you are. And no, it was great fun. I'll tell you what, I've said it so many times on the podcast. That for I was there for 15 years and had a brilliant, and Terry worked there as well. We had a brilliant but very, very punishing boss called Richard Park. And he was very, very demanding. We played hard, we worked hard, we played hard, and we laughed. We laughed for 15 years. It was such great time. Wild West, it was like Wild West times. But the relationships we had with the football clubs were special. I was talking last night with Alan Smith. Who was my co-com at the Braga game. And I said, well, you should go to training grounds. You should just go up to training grounds, sit in the canteens and have lunch with the players and say, oh, do you mind doing a couple of minutes for the radio? And George Graham was so welcoming, Johnny Lyle at West Ham and the managers. They're fantastic. And then it got bigger and bigger and we became a national thing. And we had commentary rights for 70-odd of the clubs in the country. And then money took over. And then the clubs and they wanted more money, and then TalkSport came in and everything got driven far too high, and it caused the death of Capital Gold, and I must write about it one day because it's very sad.
I remember that going up and up and up. The Arsenal games when I was there, they went up. There was something like 500 grand a season, and then before the end of the next season, it was £2 million they wanted. It just went up and up and up just for Arsenal alone.
When we started, Terry, six clubs in London. Consortium, whether there were six or ten, whatever, it didn't matter. 30 grand a year they had to share, and they were happy to do it because we used to publicise things they did, and you know, it was a symbiotic relationship. It was great fun, and I think that came through. I think that came through, and we had a real relationship with the fans. The phone-ins used to be hilarious, and it was just Terry, you worked there. It was fantastic.
It was great fun. And unfortunately, on that note, John, we have come to the end of today's podcast. Is there anything you'd like to say to push this book to our listeners?
Well, thanks for listening to me talking about it, for starters. I mean, yeah, I'm so grateful to you guys for reading it and talking to me about it.
It's fabulous.
And I'm just keen to spread the word because you know what's going to happen in the next couple of months. All the celebrities are going to get their biographies out and... trying to get a word out and push a little book about a sports fan is tricky. So yeah, any spreading the word you can do and buying the book, and if you do, leave a nice review.
Well,
and,
you got us, so we got you on. So you know, we enjoyed it. So what do we know? But we think it's great, and you should get out there and get this book. And also, you can listen to it as well. That's going to be on Audible, I imagine.
Yeah, it's on Audible. But more than anything, I'd say, you know, we're talking in August, you know, the season's just getting started. And I don't know about you, but me, it's just the most optimistic time of year. And the best thing I could say to everyone is have a good season. Whoever you support, have a good one.
Yeah, yeah.
John, you're a Spurs fan. You can't be optimistic. You're a Spurs fan. You've got to be Spursy.
Well, look what Ange has done to me. He's transformed me.
Here's to Dan, John.
But one other thing on that, before you start crying about your Tottenham, right? Tomorrow, as far as this podcast goes out, my team might not even exist. So there you go.
Scandalous, Terry. We need to do something about this. Let's go down and do some evenings there and get people in and raise some money. And maybe John will come down with his bin on his head. We've got to save Southend. That's the main thing. And get a new owner in.
Yeah. In fact, I'll tell you what. Let's have a chat with Kevin Mayer and see if we can get him on next week, the manager of Southend. And we'll find out what's going on. John, thank you very, very much.
Cheers, guys. It's been a pleasure.
You're a superstar.
Thanks, John.
Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.